My name is Andy Gordon, and this is session one on what is truth. And I want to blame Jody Kretzmann for that arrogant title. I didn't say that.
You asked for it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to talk. Much more narrowly, but I hope in a way that folds everybody in from your own experiences about accurate information. What is it? Do we want it? How do we get it? This is not truth as the metaphysicians would see it, I don't think, although we're bound to get into some of those issues. It's also not Marxist variants on truth. I don't even pretend to touch on those subjects. I don't want to. But I think that the general topic has a lot of facets that it's worth our exploring piece by piece to see what the collection of things I want to bring up gets us to. I'm going to talk about some experiences I've had, some research I've been involved in. I'm a social scientist at Northwestern University who's been working on things that have to do largely, or started with, bureaucratic records of organizations, and trying to understand how they come to be what they are. It raised a lot of larger issues than ever anticipated. And I hope I can make some of that meaningful to you as well. Now, as we talk about forms of accuracy, what accuracy means, why sometimes we don't want it even though we say we do, I'm going to use that to segue into talking about computers. And what's the relationship between computers and accuracy, writ large? That's going to be later this week, and then I'll try to follow through on that, and more generally on discussion about computers as I sense the interest, because there's so many things we can talk about over the time that's available to us. But today, let me set the tone by talking about some things that we think we've learned, at least some things we've been exposed to, looking at information in organizations. It's very typical now for social scientists to try to understand what's going on in an organization by looking at the records they keep. I think almost any of you who have been involved in something, especially where funding has been required, where you've had to report to the government, where you've had to report to a foundation or to any public agency, or be held to account to a board of directors, whatever, keep records. And those records are somehow supposed to account for what you do. Now, clearly, they don't. I mean, there's a pure physical sense in which they can't. You can't write down everything you do. But at the same time, we feel more and more that there's something more interesting and more fundamental than that going on when people decide how to record their activities. There was a famous psychologist 30 years ago and more, named Frankel Brunswick at Berkeley, who tried to take graduate students and have them follow people around all day and write down everything they did. It's an impossible task. So some selection obviously enters in, and the selection is very interesting. Today I'm going to talk about selection that has more of a political bent, but we'll be talking later about selections that even have a physiological basis, I think, that may be interesting to you as well. Well, typically, when people don't write down exactly what they do, when they somehow err, and they err deliberately, they're often said to be lying. They're corrupting the record in some way. If they say they saw 5 clients and they really saw 3, if they say they were in the office 8 hours and they were really there 6, the onus of the way in which we typically understand that is to say they did something wrong. The fault is theirs. And I'm going to try to make that whole thing a little more problematic today and try to put it in a context that may be helpful. This basic version I just talked about, this pure corruption of records. There are a lot of examples of that, and it might be helpful to start out with some illustrations. There was an agency run by a man we worked with in Illinois where children were runaways, and where he wanted to do something to cut down on the number of runaways in institutions for children. And he thought that he would use runaway as a good index of whether or not a place was pleasant. If you're running away, you must not like it, so we got to do something about the runaway problem. He received a letter from somebody who ran one of the agencies after this experiment had been going on for about 6 months, cut down on your runaways, that said with great pride, we've had no runaways in the last 6 months. And he thought that was terrific. But he wanted to find out how it happened. He sent somebody into the agency unbeknownst to them, and he found out that in the previous 3 months, everybody who'd run away and come back had had his fingers broken. So that's the way this agency achieved cutting down on the number of runaways. They'd taken that index, this is not a pun, that had been held up by some of the, by the agency as a way of counting, and they corrupted the system in order to have the count come up. I'm going to try to talk about how that's a more commonplace phenomenon that than we'd like it to be. There's a report from the last century where there was a bounty put out on foxes because foxes were decimating herds. Some farmers responded to the bounty by raising foxes and then turning in the foxes that they killed, because the bounty was directed to this index. How many foxes can we do away with? Right now, or in the last administration in Chicago, people were trying to do something about the problem of guns in public housing by putting a bounty on guns. We can imagine that there were some suspicions, especially by the police, that what this would do would cause people to steal guns in order to turn them in for a bounty. So they had to be very careful about how they were going to decide what they were going to count with respect to success. Does anybody remember about body counts in Vietnam? Lieutenant Calley, the Malay, My Lai situation. Do you remember what happened there that was extraordinary and got to people after the fact? This was a result of General William Westmoreland introducing management by objective into the way the war was being fought. And the way they were going to know whether we were winning in Vietnam was by a body count. What happened? Does anybody remember?
I remember something about that there were 3 times or 4 times the population of the whole country that was killed or something. That, the story that I remember, if you'd actually counted all these body counts and totaled them up, it was 4 times the total population. That's how I remember it.
Yeah. I don't remember a figure that large, but we're certainly in the right ballpark. There were areas of the country where more people were killed than there were. Well, the issue was first that there were soldiers, so people looked like they were making up numbers, and that was a problem. But what became worse was that civilians were being killed in order to increase the body count. That is, the focus became so much on how many bodies we could produce, and the boundary line between who knows out there who's a terrorist, right? Became so fuzzy that people took advantage of that, and what we have are some extraordinary responses that become visible and get us very nervous. Well, I think I'll avoid some technical talk about this corruption, but I think it's interesting for us to notice that there are examples of pure corruption like this that seem to be produced by the fact that somebody's counting something. All of a sudden, what we begin to focus on is not the event we were interested in, but the accounting of the event, which can be a separate thing. Some people have talked about it's the difference between producing, for example, in delinquency, counting the number of delinquents and actually knowing how many there are, versus figuring out how you decide who to count. And what I'm trying to bring up and then amplify in some other areas is those shouldn't be confused with one another. How do you decide how many people attend church on Sunday? that may depend in some instances on for what purpose that number is being used. And I want to get to some of that. And then talk about why this is important. Okay. Let me give some examples from some situations that I know relatively well and see whether they ring any bells for you. Once in a school, in a university that will remain anonymous, in a department that will remain anonymous, some secretaries received some forms that they were supposed to fill out. And the forms were to account for how much time they were spending in the office. And on average, it was supposed to be 7.5 hours a day. And so the total was something like 37.5 hours a week. And this was something the administration had come up with in order to bring departments to account, in order to know whether they were using as many secretaries as they needed and so on. Well, I happened to be present when the secretaries were learning how to deal with this new thing that had come up. And the head secretary, the administrative assistant, sat down with all the staff and looked at the form. And we have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And we have number of hours each day. And then at the bottom, you're supposed to total it up. And so the secretary said, well, the first thing you do is write 37.5 at the bottom of the page. Okay? Now, and then they say, now, you can't make it 7.5 hours a day, because that would look silly. What you do is you make it 7.5 hours one day, you make it 8 hours another day, you make it 7 hours another day, so that, obviously, there's some real variation here. But at the bottom, it comes out to 37.5 hours. Now, that was an extraordinary situation for me to view, but not for the reasons I expected to. What was extraordinary about it to me was that nobody thought they were doing anything wrong. The staff was sitting there, and everything that you might have thought of that had to do with lying was not something that had to be talked about. Nobody asked the head secretary to justify this behavior. Nobody said, this is unacceptable, and stomped out of the room. Everybody was fully participated, and there was obviously something going on to be explained, which they didn't need to explain to one another. I'll come back to that. I'm finding more and more of this, which is why I sort of want to make a bit of effort to try to play some of these out in detail. Let me give you another example, and then come back to these. Somebody came to me because they were having trouble figuring out what to do with some forms they were given. And these forms came from an inner city school. These forms were pushing something called client evaluation, which we can spend some time on. But in this case, since it was an inner city school, what the forms were student evaluations of teachers. These were teachers in an inner city school, and the students that were being evaluated were bilingual teachers in the bilingual program. And the students were asked to fill out on a scale that always went from 1 to 5, repeatedly across items, where this is not very happy, and this is happy, how they like the school, how do they like the teachers, how are things going, are they having a good time, are they learning anything, all right? Now, the reason this was handed to me is because all the forms came back looking essentially the same. They weren't crumpled up. There was not any peanut butter on any of them. These were fourth graders. None seemed to be lost. And more revealing than that, every one of the circles had a little curlicue around it. So obviously, the same person had filled it out. There was some sophistication. They'd used a different pencil for every one, or a different pen. And they'd not all been done at exactly the same time, so they were slightly sloppier. But nevertheless, it was obvious that no kid had filled these forms out. Okay. And the question was, what do we do with that information? And what I, and then I, rather, but this became, this is supposed to be a technical conversation about how to correct somehow statistically for whatever error there might be in this. What it turned out to be as we talked was a problem much more, much deeper than that, that I'll try to get back to. Because when I asked the person who had done this evaluation and was nervous about the data, what the school was like and what these teachers were like, they said, it's fine, the teachers are really good. The teachers are doing a good job. This is a good program. So what are we supposed to do with a situation where we have a bunch of lying, corrupting people running running a school and doing a good job at it, who turn in these kinds of data? Well, I'm going to come back to this too. All right. Now, in both of these cases, one because I happened to be present, and another because there was some obvious error in the way this has been dealt with, some obvious corruption. This was something that had come to our attention. We knew the situation well enough to know that there was a problem somehow with the forms. Now notice that the secretaries, who go through this all the time, were quite sophisticated in how they dealt with it. They knew what the bottom line, quote unquote, had to be. They knew how to introduce some natural variation in it, so typically the person who received the forms wouldn't notice that they were wrong. Okay? They looked like they made sense. And in this case, we have somebody who didn't know how to get rid of the curlicue when they drew a circle. So the error came immediately to our attention. But that doesn't distinguish between either of these in how accurate they are. Neither of them is accurate. Neither of them is an attempt by the people somehow to represent what's going on in their situation. Now, what is going on? This is a department that's running extremely well. It's properly staffed. The faculty to whom these people are supposed to be providing services are happy. The work is getting done. There isn't a lot of slack. People take breaks because people are people, that try to address the rhythm of their lives. Okay. It's a sensitive department that tries to respond to its staff. This form didn't come from the department. It came from the administration of the university, from people who never come to the department, who have no idea what's really going on, who are trying to bring the system to account without achieving any understanding of what's going on there. So this number becomes the only way in which they understand whether this particular department is affected. And the secretaries are being asked, with full knowledge of what's really going on there, to take this seriously. And if they're not taking it seriously, they're lying, they're told. In this situation, we have an inner city school. I don't know how many of you have worked in inner city schools, but they're all decimated of resources. It's very hard to get funds to get anything done. Whenever any opportunity, like a bilingual program, comes along, you grab it and you use it for everything you can. It turned out that the teachers in this bilingual program were the best teachers the school had. They were not only being used for bilingual education, they were being used for a variety of real teaching activities, real things that had to go on in that school. Okay? And here we have, once again, people in Washington in this case, who have brought forms, handed them with what seems to be the best of intentions to students, and asked them to fill them out. And students will fill them out according to whatever criteria they use, not perhaps realizing the consequences of what they've done, right? The consequence is that if the ratings don't come out the way some person in Washington who doesn't understand the school expects them to, these teachers may be yanked and sent somewhere else. If those teachers are yanked, the whole school suffers. Now, there is a problem here. Whose problem is it?
Administrator, among others.
Hmm?
The administrators of the school, among others.
And what? Who do you blame in a situation like this? it's in our lexicon, in the way we do our business, we usually blame this person and say they're a lying thief and we've got to do something about them. So we need monitors to look over their heads, not to see whether they're doing their job right, but to see if they're filling out their forms correctly. I was brought into an agency in Chicago that deals with runaways, and it is a model agency. You just have to walk in the door and you know it's a model agency. They know what to do with those kids, and what they do is spend time with them. They come in, the kid needs time, they stop what they're doing and spend time with the kid, a lot of time, quality time. Isn't that our new phrase? What they stop doing in order to spend quality time is fill out forms. Now I have this agency, this irony hit me particularly hard because I was invited in by the people in Washington to do something about this problem. And the problem they wanted to deal with was the forms, not the agency. They knew the agency was doing a good job, but they had superiors who were putting the numbers in machines. And this agency was resolute. They said, you've given us, you know, what do we have? $6,000 a year, let's guess, for each member of our staff. We don't make any money. You want us to take half those people and get them to fill out forms. The forms these people filled out were 30 forms, 30 pages of just incredibly complex material for every kid. And then several pages every time there was a change in the status of a kid. They said, we have to choose between filling out the forms and serving the kids. What do you want us to do? You can close us down if you make us fill out the forms. So I was brought in by the federal government to help them get the forms filled out without in any way disrupting what they were doing as an agency. I was being asked by the people to whom they report to participate in the corruption. The only reason this is possible is because the people in Washington knew, at some level, knew this agency well enough to know it was doing a good job. I think it turns out to be quite a common phenomenon where people are put in the business of trying to do things accurately when many times they're not able to. It's a real problem. Let me go through a few more of these to try to flash it out in a few directions, especially in preparation for some pretty heavy-duty stuff I want to bring up tomorrow. And then open it up to questions, because it would be surprised me if none of you had any examples of this from your own experience, examples of things like this, where, for example, somebody calls you on the phone and asks what you think of something, or fill out a short questionnaire, and you resent every question you're asked, because it turns out there's no way you can answer it that accurately represents what you really think. W.H. Auden had a poem that begins, thou shalt not fill out a questionnaire nor commit a social science. And there's something going on here that's related to that. And the methodologies we use to achieve what we call accurate understanding that has now penetrated all our lives that we resent, and yet we don't know how to get a hold of it. Let me give you come at this from a slightly different angle. What should I do when I'm asked to write a letter of recommendation for a student?
The student should first ask if you can write them a good letter of recommendation.
So we already have a strong bias with respect to what the letters are meaning, because we're choosing people who, we as students choose people who will write us good letters. Now suppose I want to write a balanced letter. What does that mean? How do I do it? What should I do? One of the things I always want to know is who's asking and why do they want to know? For what purpose is this letter being written? What is the meaning of the answer I'm going to give you? How do I do it right? What standards do I use? How do I know what you're going to make of my letter? This situation where one decides what to write because of the conclusion you want to derive, getting the student hired or whatever, we call proactive record keeping. A lot of what we're expected to look for is called reactivity. as if people somehow blindly write in response to what they get. What I think people usually do, not only in these situations, but in many others, and writing letters is another one of them, is behave proactively. That is, they figure out what the purpose is they want to achieve, and that's the answer they give. It's not meant to be an accurate recording of what they did. It's meant to be an accurate vehicle for achieving their purpose, whatever it is. And it's only coincidental when these things happen to come together. And it happens that the truth as we understand it, even if we understood it, and we'll be getting to that more later, is what you write down. I was told to hold this up. Having been too late to order books, what I did is take a number of there is in the bookstore, a set of readings that consist of a number of things that are relevant to what we'll be talking about over the next several days. The one that's the most relevant to this is something called Proactive Records, Reflections on the Village Watchman. These are all only a few pages long, and you might, I think, find them useful. If you're going to continue with me, another that you might want to read is called The Judges, The Judged, Not the Judges, An Insider's View of Mental Retardation. Both of these are among several relatively straightforward articles in this set of readings I put together. Okay, now, I want to talk a little in the same vein about grade inflation. The turning point for grade inflation, does anybody know when we started to worry about that? It isn't obvious because it's sort of with us now. Do you know what I mean by grade inflation? I mean, you don't give gentlemen C's anymore. You give gentlemen B's and you give anybody else an A. Grades no longer have the same meaning as numerical meaning as they used to. There's some schools where once you get in the door, you're virtually guaranteed straight A's because that's their curve. It's a problem that people are really worried about in universities. I tried to trace this down by talking to people at Northwestern, where it is often described as a problem. And the turning point for this was Vietnam. The time when grade inflation really came to be a problem on most campuses was at the time of Vietnam. Why? What do you think? Draft dodgers, student deferment, there are a lot of ways to describe the phenomenon. But another way to say it is that we were being asked, we thought, to grade how students were doing in class. And that grade was being used as a vehicle to decide who was going to go in the Army. Now, it was nothing to do with the Army that we had in mind when we were grading students. Grading is somehow about how you're doing in class. And sometimes it's supposed to be a message that you carry with you so that you will do differently next time, okay? Or that you will be rewarded. But that isn't the use to which it was being put during this period of time. It was being used as a vehicle for drafting students. What's the source of the corruption in that situation? How do you decide who's done it wrong? And besides, who can ever decide in the first place what's accurate grading in most cases? Okay, what am I doing here? Let me give you a few more examples that may be helpful. I worked with agencies. In a variety of agencies who were supposed to intervene on families where there were problems with child abuse. They're supposed to diagnose the problem and then deliver the appropriate solution, whatever that's, you know, solutions vary with the times. We decide from year to year what the appropriate intervention is. Now, people who've had experience with this over the years tend to get very jaundiced about public agencies and the adequacy of public agencies as interveners in this process. It frequently happens that in the most troubled situations, state intervention only makes things worse. Families are torn apart so people can't see one another anymore. Somebody is in our state, we had a problem with kids arbitrarily being sent to Texas out of Illinois because there weren't enough places of certain kinds to put them in Illinois. So if you said a kid had a particular problem, it was what it meant was that you were going to send them out of state. Okay. And you might know the child well enough to know that the worst thing you could do is have that kind of complete severance of relationship with a family so poor that they'd never be able to get to Texas. How do workers respond to the situation? Once again, I was brought in to help develop an information system that brought these people to account. Because the problem was that a kid would have problem X, and they would sometimes write down that they had problem Y. Why were they lying to us like this? Well, the reason they were lying is because they knew that X led to Texas, and Y led to other kind of agency. So they would call a child Y, not because it was the best description of what the problem was in the world somehow, but because that was how they achieved the outcome they knew was best for this child, how they kept the kid from going to Texas. The worst thing we could have done, given the politics in Illinois at the time, and given the difficulty of deriving the right solution for children, was to say to social workers, you're not allowed to use your sensitive understanding of each individual kid in order to make a decision. You have instead to respond to an arbitrary form that doesn't fit the kids you're working with. Okay. So our solution would, in our estimation, have only made the problem worse. We would have helped the state come up with something, but we wouldn't have helped the kids, and we certainly wouldn't have helped the workers. It's a tough problem, because it also means that the records, when you look at them, don't properly tell you what kind of kids you've got. They tell you instead something about mechanisms that are being used by workers in order to certain aims that they think are important. I was in an agency with working with children who had been incarcerated, so this is a tougher bunch. And we developed an information system in order to find out what was really going on in this agency. We developed an information system for the man who ran it, a charismatic leader. Now, this was a fascinating model they'd set up. They called it case management, and now there are various forms of case management. But the point was that the workers who worked with him didn't deliver services directly. What they did was contract out for services to be delivered by somebody else, and their job was to make sure that whatever was necessary was being done. In this agency, with this charismatic leader in charge, we were able to come up with what I regarded as an incredibly rich and useful information system that really told him the things he needed to know in order to facilitate his understanding of what people were up to. But it was like this. We would develop a system, and we would hand it to him, and what it was a very complete description, as best we could come up with it, of what kids were doing, and where they were, and how much progress they were making, and so on and so forth. And he would look at it and say, that's not right. This is useful. This helps me. I've got some information here I didn't have before. But you got this wrong. Something about this is wrong. I know that kid, or I know that situation well enough to know something was wrong. So it was very synergistic, very interactive. We were an armament which we were giving him to add to his body of knowledge. And it was an exhilarating experience for all of us. As far as I was concerned, the system we'd come up with was working. And this guy knew his workers well enough to know that if somebody didn't show up in court, he'd be on their neck the next day. And he'd hound them to make sure that it never happened again, because he had decided for himself what the most responsible activity was by his staff. He left. He was too good to stay. He left. Elevated to an agency where it turned out he was no longer able to deal with a problem. Maybe we'll come back to that. And he was replaced by a bureaucrat. Charismatic out, bureaucrat in. We gave the same database that we were so proud of last week, to this new bureaucratic worker who wanted to punch the clock, who wanted to get in and out as much as possible. And our vehicle, our information system, became the way in which she knew how the agency was doing. It was a substitute for knowledge rather than an addition to knowledge, so that she would take her forms go behind the door, look at this statistical database, and that was how she thought she knew how effectively they were dealing with juveniles. It was a tragedy. Our same information system had become a problem rather than a solution. And it hadn't changed. It was the same database as it had been, but in other hands, it had an entirely different meaning. So even the information base had to be appreciated with respect to how it was being used by certain people. Okay. How many of you have heard about Taylorism? Do you know about Frederick Taylor? Turn of the century, attempts to bring some objectification through the 20s to how people did typically in industrial settings. Well, Taylorism was an attempt to build some very objective counting. And this fellow Taylor also was very influential at some universities. And there's a wonderful story about a professor at Harvard who was visited by a young faculty member who'd been appointed to find out how much time he spent preparing for lectures. And the fellow came in and said to him, it was a professor of Shakespeare, and he brought his form and he said, how much time did you spend preparing for your last lecture? How much time do you typically spend preparing for lectures? How much time does it take being a professor? And the fellow looked at him and talked to him about what it means to work in a university and how you account for your time and what's thinking time and what's appropriate use of time. And they have what he thought was a very nice conversation. And when the conversation was over, the young man turned to his record and said, now, once again, how much time did you spend preparing for your last lecture? And the professor answered, all my life, young man, all my life. Okay. There's a problem here about taking these situations, which are so complex, and reducing them to what we call information, and taking that information as the body of knowledge we have for understanding how successful we're being in Vietnam, how successful bilingual education is, whether secretaries use their time appropriately. we're headed in that direction more and more as society devotes itself more and more to these objective criteria. That's a subject, that's one part of understanding that I wanted to at least bring up today with a variety of examples. Let's see if we can have some conversation and see if this resonates with any of your own experiences. Whether it sounds like anything any of you have participated in. Is this foreign territory?
The first example I thought of was in our home congregation. We're trying to rebuild a youth program, and the problem that we had on it was, how do you measure success? You measure success if one comes, you need 20 to have it be a successful program. If you only get 3, does it warrant having it every week? You know, do you only have it once a month? Mm-hmm. So that was something that we really had to consider.
You're talking about grades. I certainly resonate to, especially coming out in an environment, those who say that communicate to the student a sense of worth, and the student will begin to achieve what is expected.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you communicate to the student that he or she is just not very confident, and that's exactly how they're performed, not very confident. And so here is a situation where staff people were very much into this educational psychology and motivational theory, and their grade curves are all A's and B's.
Right.
Because they're concerned, above all, to get these kids to perform. Whereas some who maybe are in the sciences, et cetera, and concerned about absolute standards and how they really did on a test, and their students are all getting C's, a lot of D's, and they're known as tough graders, and anybody who goes into those classes, you know, kind of is seen as a grader,
right,
in contrast to some of the other departments.
Right.
It really is a different objective. Becomes involved, your term proactive, I think, proactive employees.
isn't trying to give an accurate description so much as it is an instrument for achieving another goal.
Right. Please.
I work in a hospital setting, and I've been away for about a year and a half. It's really interesting to me to see what the DRG system has done with cost pricing. You have to fit into the diagnosis, has to fit into one of the categories, but the bottom line is
diagnosis, what groups?
Diagnostic related
groups. It's the new strategy
to get the money
that the government is using to make sure that nobody spends too much time in the hospital, that there aren't too many hysterectomies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everything has to be properly described and then documented. And the documentation is not typically what it is that people did, but what it is you have to say that they did in order to make things come out.
The key word for the report is the diagnosis.
Right.
So the
issue is the records are now to support the diagnosis. Not to the, so there's a sense in which the records are no longer about what they used to be about. Let me give you a couple of things from the hospital, because the hospital setting is really interesting. First, Margo's father died recently. He was in the hospital in Florida. And they want, and under DRGs, it's that reason, and they felt that he needed to be in the hospital longer than the DRGs would allow. They were empathetic to this problem. What did they do? They changed his diagnosis. They called him whatever they had to call him in order to, they behaved proactively. It's more and more, it's not an occasional issue anymore. And it's also, as I think we'll be talking about later in the week, it's about social relations too. It's not just about not about record keeping. There was a similar situation in New York where about hysterectomies that I was thinking about, where there was a quota. Hysterectomies are bad, so there's a quota on the number of hysterectomies. But again, these strategies are often followed blindly, so the hospitals are in trouble if they have too many hysterectomies. But also if they don't have any. Because if they don't have any, they figure they must be lying. So we have this wonderful example of a hospital that said it had a hysterectomy that it didn't, in order that nobody would notice them. It's like this. It's calling it 7 hours, 8 hours, 7.5 hours, because if they always called it 7.5, somebody would notice, even if that were an accurate description of what they were doing. Let me tell you another thing that I think really falls in this domain. Hospital record keeping, to begin with, is about what doctors do. It's not about what health is. And I want to make sure that we don't confuse those, although I don't want to spend a lot of time on health. So, for example, if you wanted to look at medical records to figure out how many splints, how many people came in with broken legs in the last month, you could find that out because we have to know how many splints to order next month. And so record keeping with respect to how the problem is defined in that medical domain in an emergency room is accurate. This is the kind of accuracy that we'll get back to too. But if you want to know how many people are in the hospital this week because of an accident that happened at a corner that didn't have a stoplight at dusk, you can't get the answer to that question, because the medical system doesn't collect information about stoplights and about busy corners. You understand? So if your solution, and most people now describe the health problem in the United States is not a medical problem. It has to do with prevention. It has to do with early intervention and things like that. Well, in many communities in which Jody and I and others have worked, the problem is a traffic problem. People located near the freeway, somebody gets off the freeway and goes down a street in a neighborhood they don't live in order to avoid traffic at a rate they're not concerned about hitting people they're not concerned about. It's a problem in some areas that the freeways exploit, in my estimation. Now,
the information you need in order to figure out whether that's a problem that can be dealt with is not something you'll get out of medical records. They really are medical records, they're not health records. So I want to describe this as another kind of distortion. There's a model that we put out that has to do with what's the appropriate body of knowledge to work from. And then we respond to that model, and nothing else.
You go ahead. You also have to add now the fear of malpractice as to what the record reflects.
That's right. The fear of malpractice, now we have an insurance system that's entirely out of control because it's really a whole system that's being responded to proactively, right? Where did I read an estimate that in daycare centers, daycare centers now can't get insurance, typically. They can't afford insurance. The insurance industry, they do have records on the claims paid out. The largest claim paid out to any daycare center last year was $15,000, the largest single claim. The total claim to daycare centers was 3% of the money that was paid in insurance payments. And despite that, insurance money is skyrocketing. Now the insurance industry says they're correcting for something else, but do you notice the whole thing is hidden in their accounting system? And it's not something that we have the capacity, the competence, to figure out. I'll be getting back to this information bases that are competent producing later in the week. Derek, you have?
I just had another example of doctor's bills. I was blessed to have a doctor who would only write insurance only, which meant that the insurance paid anything else I wouldn't have to pay. The problem was I hadn't met the deductible yet, so he wasn't giving anything in either, and it caused the bookkeeping department all sorts of problems. And so they tried to figure out a plan to bill me even more money in order for them to get their part so that I would at least fall from my deductible so they can start getting their
80%. Do you understand? If you look at these records, they aren't any of them what they're supposed to be. And I think that is typically the case now. They don't describe even what they were set up to describe, much less what it is that you might want to know if you weren't interested in their descriptions. So it's a funny kind of process that's got a life of its own that nobody seems to be able to slow down. Here we have these bureaucrats favoring an agency that's doing these runaways, and it's totally out of their control. They have no way to say, this is what you should know, and this is a damn good agency, let's stand behind them. What they have to do instead is come up with a body of knowledge that will persuade somebody that knows nothing about the program that it's a good program.
How do they know it's a good agency?
It's a good question. I'm going to spend a lot of time on that, and how one knows differently from this what's going on, but it's because they spend time with it. And I have a lot of, I think, interesting, useful examples of that kind of knowledge in a variety of settings.
Yeah. Let me take you from the medical field into the parsonage with the pastor. For 23 years, I was a parish pastor, and I thought I put in pretty good hours, pretty long hours, and I was under work culture, so I didn't take too many days off. And then I was asked to do some executive work, and my wife was the secretary. And I was paid on a monthly basis, and she was paid on an hourly basis. And we would come to the end of the day, and I would say, boy, we put in a pretty good day today, didn't we? And she would look at her record, and she said, yeah, about 6 hours or something. Or in other words, and that really opened my eyes to what really happens to us as pastors.
Right.
We think we're putting in a lot of hours when somehow or other, I don't know where the hours go. But they're not there.
That's not right. Whatever that is,
that's
not right.
There's something wrong. My first thought was, well, is she keeping accurate record? Is she cutting herself short? But we watched that. Well, I had one pastor who was serving a congregation. I was in supervisory capacity, see? And then he was asked to serve another congregation just to preach on Sunday morning. And you know, his work in his own parish just dropped down like that. This is a mission congregation. And I was asked to go in and check. Well, he said, you know, I have to preach over there. Well, I said, now, let's look at that one. How much time do you spend on that extra work? Another sermon, though, same sermon. How long does it take you to drive down there? About 45 minutes at the most, and back. In other words, you're putting in about 3 hours of extra work a week than you did before. Is that a conflict? And furthermore, you're driving through your own parish most of that way, and you could do all the calls that you did before on the same trip.
Right. So you could be, in that case, efficient.
You're talking about the same question.
Right.
And I'm sure, and I don't want to leave the impression that we as pastors try to deceive ourselves or try to deceive others. It's just the situation the way to know.
Yeah, see, that's why I want to get away from this blaming talk. I think in almost all the cases we're talking about, these are good people trying to do good work and deal with a system that's corrupting what them, and then blaming them. I mean, that's the irony. But somehow at the bottom, no, I'm not talking about my life. The stuff at the beginning, raising foxes in order to get money from a bounty, that's a different problem. But I think from then on, we're talking about situations where people are doing the best they can. Somebody says they're doing a bad job, and how they know it, they know it according to some information becomes the most important way in which they understand their activity.
I found one pastor who, these were still the days of smoking pipe. He said a half hour a day smoked, cleaning his pipe, he figured that was worse than the parish.
Right. Well, as long as he's sitting behind his desk, he's allowed to count it.
That's right.
That proves he's allowed to count it. Jody?
I was thinking about times when I hear pastors talking about numbers in the way that Andy's talking about. One of the conversations I've heard a lot among pastors whom I know is about how many members they've got in their congregation and what the pluses and minuses are about what they call cleaning their roles, right? Whether it pays to go over their role to get rid of inactive members, people they haven't seen for months, or whether it pays to keep them on there. And it seems to me, as an outsider, not a pastor, it seems to me like a conversation that goes on absolutely constantly among them, and that there are different positions on it, that some people are four square for a clean role and other people think it's fine.
Okay, I can answer that question very quickly. If you don't do anything with inactive in the first month that he's inactive, you're wasting your time and following him up. You better go out and find the new source for Christ. It's a very simple answer, but I can prove that.
But the church gets into the ballgame that Andy's talking about by trying to count souls.
That's right.
That's why I'm putting the zero in there. See,
oh, and a lot of these systems can be interrupted by people that have some integrity with respect to the process. But that's not always who you're responding to when you fill these forms out.
In fact, we've developed such a sophisticated set of statistics that we have active members and inactive members, so that we can still talk about our membership being 4 million plus, but when the congregation is apportioned for how much money we have to give to the synodical or district offices, we only work on active numbers.
Right.
So we have two sets of statistics to use.
Right. What if for the situation? Right. That's double bookkeeping is a very common phenomenon we really didn't get into, but a very important one. I don't know how many, some of which we might want to wait for the tape to go off to explain.
He's the pastor who chastises his people in filling out their income tax because they use a double standard. He uses a double standard in souls.
Well, but just the double standard, it's that sense of that I want to get. The point is, he wouldn't be doing that if he didn't have some sense that this information were going to be used in some perverted sense elsewhere. I mean, it's his prediction about. I agree with you, if we were all in a situation with equal power, equal information, and equal understanding of what the appropriate level of activity is, none of this would be happening, but I have yet to see that situation.
But he starts with the wrong assumption, that they're going to misuse my figures.
Well, it may be a practiced assumption. I can't speak for these churches, but I can speak for situations I've been in. Where it would be a real problem. Let me raise one more irony, and then we'll see how the... Actually, we're about out of time. One more thing, Bill. We're now trying to deal with making information better by giving everybody access to information, right? We know about the freedom of information laws, and now students have the rights to their folders, and the teachers have to give the student and the not only the student, but the family, information about what's going on. What has happened, would you think? Double bookkeeping. There are, in almost every school, two sets of records. There's the record you show the anybody who asks, and they're the real records that you keep elsewhere. Let's talk about
freedom of information with respect to promotion or hiring. I have a friend that's in a law firm where they were, where some other law firm got in trouble for not having promoted somebody according to some guidelines they thought they understood. And so now when they have promotion meetings, they write nothing down, not one word, so that there's nothing to subpoena. We get letters of recommendation on students, which nobody believes anymore. And so if it's important, and they're really interested in the person, the next thing you get is a phone call where they say, "No, what's this person really like?" So in the interest of opening up everybody's participation, in a situation where some people start out with a lot more power of decision-making than others, it doesn't necessarily make things flow or make any document that one might get a hold of more quote-unquote accurate than it was before. It just may make it different in a new kind of way. These are situations which I'll be spending more time. Did you have a
comment? I've been both a student and a teacher the past year and have asked for recommendations and have written recommendations. They waive access to the file, or they don't waive access, and they are told to sign the line that says that they waive access, otherwise the letter, quote unquote, is not believed.
Right.
And the person will not give an honest evaluation.
And it's
get around that, like telling students, okay, sign that, and I'll give you a Xerox copy.
Right. There are a lot of situations where people try to figure out strategies which let them come up with credible information in spite of this. What I'm trying to describe is a system, situation that was set up to derive credible information, which we're now having to escape in every way we can in order to get credible information. And the manifestations are, I think, serious with respect to understanding. There was a couple other more technical things I wanted to get into, but we're going to wear one another out. And it says 1 minute of five, so I think let's call it a day. Okay. Tomorrow I'm going to get